Coming up on Philosophy Talk, what makes a well-lived life?
I imagine in your life, 2,000 years, you have had some sickness.
Yes, I have had some sickness.
What is the worst thing that ever happened to you?
I had a headache. You want to hear about a headache?
I'd like to.
I had a pull over to the side of the road.
What do the aged owe to the young? What do the young owe to the aged?
I have over 42,000 children, and not one comes to visit me.
Today, aging and the well-lived life.
Recorded live at the Classic Residence by Hyatt Palo Alto with support from the Stanford Humanities Center.
Old man, take a look at my life. I'm a lot like you.
2,006 months young. But I don't look more than 1,600, right?
No.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We've taken Philosophy Talk on the road. We're recording the program in front of a live audience in Palo Alto, California.
Our thinking originates just down the road at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And it migrates from there to the air via the signals of 91.7 KALW, local and innovative public radio for San Francisco. And from the radio to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. I think, therefore I blog.
Today's program is made possible in part by funding from the Stanford Humanities Center. We're meeting in person with some of our listeners at the Classic Residence by Hyatt on Sand Hill Road next to the Stanford campus. Welcome, folks, to Philosophy Talk.
John, this is a great venue for our topic today. Our topic today is aging and the well-lived life. And those of our listeners may not know that the Classics Residence by Hyatt is a senior living community. So I think our audience will have a lot of wisdom because they live this question every day.
Well, I'm sure compared to you, they're quite wise. But I myself identify more with the audience. I'm kind of getting up there. So I think we'll have a lot of wisdom to share with you.
Well, I'm eager to learn from your superior wisdom, John, as always. But look, let's think about the philosophical question about aging. You know, in one way, everything ages. Rocks age, whales age, the earth ages, human beings age. What's the big philosophical deal?
Well, you're cutting right down to the quick of things, Ken. There is a big difference between rocks, animals, and humans. Though rocks age, and they get older and older, animals age more like humans. They have a date when they're born, and there is going to be a date when they die, and they get closer and closer to the latter as they get further and further from the former. But with humans, it's quite special because we have a conception of the whole thing. We think about the whole process. We form goals and anticipate things and regret things and rue things and think about things in terms not just of the moment, but of our whole life. So that makes aging rather special when it comes to humans.
I see that. Because this is aging and the well-lived life, aging and flourishing. Does this special thing about human aging give us special challenges about how to flourish?
Well, sure, because, and here's where philosophers starting with Plato and Aristotle have a lot of wisdom to distill. Being happy, flourishing, living a good life for a human doesn't mean quite what it does, say, for my dog Gretchen. She's happy if she's got a bone, a full stomach, a bowl of water, a squirrel to chase. Day after day after day, the same thing makes her happy. But for humans, it's not just having pleasurable experiences and squirrels to chase. We have bigger ambitions that form our life, and flourishing involves all of that, too.
Right. We tell ourselves this narrative of our lives. It's got a beginning, middle, and end. And part of the flourishing is a part of the character of that narrative. And as more of the past is behind you, and there's more to remember and less to anticipate, you move different places in that narrative. And sometimes you just have to reinitialize a narrative, you know, because one of the things about aging is the brute facts of biology. Biology, I hate to say, can sometimes be a bastard and can deliver you these surprises, and then you have to reinitialize your narrative.
But if you're a human and you've thought about your life and you have a sense of self, that helps you move through these changes. And, you know, it's not just biology. Sometimes it's just plain catastrophe that changes things suddenly.
That's true. And our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Cornelli, went out and talked to somebody who flourished despite a catastrophe. She files this report.
There's one image Harry Lewenstein will never forget.
as I was being wheeled into the operating room at midnight, I heard the doctor say to the nurses, 70 years old, on a bicycle.
This was in southern Portugal nearly 10 years ago. After spending his career as an executive in the electronics industry, Lewenstein was settling into a leisurely retirement, including frequent bicycle trips like this one.
We were having a great time. It was a beautiful day, and I wasn't paying enough attention to where I was going. Went down a hill, going a little too fast, hit a bump. I was converted into an instant quadriplegic. At that point, I was 70 years old, and that was the end of my active life.
An arduous recovery process followed.
I'm totally paralyzed from the mid-chest level down. I have no feeling whatsoever of any sort, no sense of temperature, and I have no useful hands. I cannot use my fingers. I don't have the ability to pick up things. I have very limited arm movement. The rehab consisted primarily of teaching me how to use whatever facilities I still had. Hello?
Hello, Harry?
Yes.
Is your wife home?
No, she's not.
The apartment Lewenstein shares with his wife is set up so he can eat, drink, answer the phone, and use the computer, all without help. To type, he grasps a prong in each of his stiff, curled hands.
Let me just do the standard phrase here. Well, I don't have any incoming email.
Lewenstein has faced extraordinary challenges, but he says the process of aging is the same for everyone. It just happened a lot faster to him.
I aged instantaneously. In October 12, 1997, at 10 o'clock in the morning, I was a healthy, upper middle-aged male riding a bicycle. At 11 o'clock, I was a total invalid. I've adapted to it. I've had a lot of time to think about all aspects of aging. I've boiled it down to what I call the three M's: memory, mobility, medical.
Nearly 10 years after the accident, Lewenstein remains committed to living his life to the fullest.
I still get emotional when I think of the effects that all of this had on my family. But other than that, I don't feel sorry for myself. I don't have anybody to blame. I don't dwell on it.
He does maintain a sense of humor.
There are a couple of advantages. I had serious back problems before the accident, severe back pain. I haven't had a single bit of back pain since the accident. it's sort of black humor. I'm not going to live forever. So to the degree that I can, I will enjoy whatever time I have.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Classic Residence by Hyatt in Palo Alto, California. I'm John Perry, and with me here is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined by our guest, Laura Carstensen. She's professor of psychology at Stanford University. She's director of the Lifespan Development Laboratory and author of many, many things about the psychology of aging, including social structures, aging, and self-regulation in the elderly. Laura, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Hi, Laura. John Perry here. I want to start with a quote and a question. The quote is from Marilyn Ferguson's The Aquarian Conspiracy. She says this: of all the self-fulfilling prophecies in our culture, the assumption that aging means decline in poor health is probably the deadliest. So is she right? And if that's not what aging means, what does it mean?
She is right. Beliefs and the general public and in the scientific community too, that aging is simply a downward intractable spiral are wrong, and a great barrier to thinking creatively and productively about flourishing and aging.
Have we always thought of aging that way? I mean, has it changed how people have thought of aging? You know, philosophers like to use the notions like socially constructed, that the very concept of aging might be a socially constructed category. So it might vary from culture to culture and time to time. What do you think?
Well, our stages of life are clearly social constructions. There's nothing magic about 65, you turn old. And so we make these things up. But I think we're particularly confused about old age because old age, if you will, is young. It's new in the history of humankind.
What do you mean by that?
Well, through most of human evolution, life expectancy was about 27. And then it inched up in 1800s. It was kind of in the mid-30s. And then in 1900 in the United States, life expectancy was 47. And by the end of that century, life expectancy was 77.
But people were always living into their 80s and 90s, weren't they? It was just that the average was brought down by all the infant mortality and disease that took teenagers and young people.
It's exactly right that much of the increase in life expectancy comes from saving the lives of the youngest in the population. But life expectancy has increased at all ages across the last 100 years. And there weren't very many old people. So even though you're right, there have been old people since, you know, whenever we can record history. But, for example, in the United States, in 1900, 4% of the population was over 65. So to be blunt, when 4% of the population is a certain group, any group, whatever it is, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter that much
so
what they're like.
So the category of the old up until recently just was not a very sort of socially prominent,
yeah.
socially consequential category?
From the perspective of society, it wasn't that relevant. When a quarter of the population is over 65, it matters, and it matters to all of us, young and old alike.
That's kind of frightening because since I got old enough to get into the theater half price, I've been really enjoying it. But if all of a sudden there's going to be all these older people, they'll put the prices back up.
Well, especially if all the older people have all the money and the younger people, yeah. But so, okay, so the emergence of the category of the old, that's a 20th century thing.
As a normative stage in life, yes. John is right. I mean, it's not a brand new thing historically, but it wasn't typical.
Let me ask you a little bit different question. Now, given that there's always been old people, even though not so many, it raises the question to a scientist like yourself, why? I mean, there aren't old dogs. Why did evolution make us such that some of us, and increasingly more of us, live so old? Do we actually perform any function? Most of us quit reproducing a long time ago.
Wait a minute. There are dogs that are old for dogs.
Yeah.
But that's a good question. That's a good back to John's real question. It's an excellent question.
You know, there's a philosopher, historian of aging, Thomas Cole, and he says that one of the greatest challenges before us now is to try to figure out what old age is for, mm-hmm. now that we've received it. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some people who think old age as a normative stage is just a byproduct of young people surviving past those early critical years, and there's really nothing about old age that's anything except leftover years. But there's some reason to think that older people in a population have a lot to contribute to their offspring and their offspring's ability to keep their genes in the gene pool. It's called the grandmother hypothesis, and some people think that's actually why humans get old.
But wait a minute.
Grandfathers don't have anything to do with it?
You know, as it turns out, they don't.
Oh, my gosh.
It's an interesting story about why.
Well, why don't... Wait. So there is a reason why there are old women around, but no reason why there are old men around? Is that basically...
Well, the old men might be the byproduct part, but here's the story. And this is true not just for humans, but it's true for vervet monkeys and lions and some other mammals. The presence of a grandmother increases the likelihood that a grandchild will survive. Mm. Kristen Hawkes, an anthropologist, has done some observational work in hunting and gathering societies in Africa today. And the observation is this, you know, the women go out and gather, and after the second child is born, you see a peak in gathering in the grandmother. She's taking care of the older child because the mother is now paying more attention to the new infant. And the presence of a grandmother increases the likelihood that that infant will survive. So some people think that's why we continue to see older people, and that's also why humans are as smart as they are, because the grandmother's knowledge helps the survival of the offspring.
So basically all the advice that mothers-in-law get grief for giving their daughters-in-law and sons and sons-in-law isn't so bad.
It's keeping them alive.
It's keeping them alive. But so tell me, just tell me briefly, I feel, as a male, I feel kind of left out of this story.
You want to know
why is it? Why is it that we're just a byproduct?
So I had lunch with Kristen Hawkes a few years ago, and I asked her that question because it didn't make a lot of sense to me. And in fact, if you look at gathering, males gather more than females at any age. So males are gathering too. And I said, why wouldn't it matter? You know, what about the grandfathers? And she said, the grandfathers don't share.
Oh, my goodness. On that sad note, I'll tell our listeners and our audience that this is a special edition of Philosophy Talk coming to you from the Classic Residence in Palo Alto, California. We're talking about aging and the well-lived life with our guest, Laura Carstensen.
We've been talking about different conceptions of aging. Next, we're going to talk about flourishing through change. As we age, our bodies, our personalities, our emotions, our memories all undergo profound changes. What does it take for us to flourish in the face of all these metamorphoses?
Flourishing in the seasons of life, plus questions and comments from you, our live audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
And that's too high for you.
Jerry Lee Lewis with special guest George Jones and Don't Be Ashamed of Your Age. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. And we're discussing aging and the well-lived life in front of a live studio audience at the Classic Residence by Hyatt in Palo Alto, California.
And in case there's anyone out in radio land that doesn't know this, the Classic Residence by Hyatt is a senior living community. So people in our live audience live our question every day. For those of you in our live audience, we're eager to have you share your thoughts with us and our listeners. Don't be shy. Share your wisdom about how to thrive throughout the later seasons of life.
Our guest is Stanford psychologist Laura Carstensen. Now, Laura, people tend to think of aging, I think, mostly in terms of stuff that happens to your body. And as we were saying at the last segment about decline of your body and your other faculties. But your research highlights that there are some really profound psychological changes that we undergo as we age. Tell us briefly.
Well, humans are uniquely able to monitor time, not just clock time and calendar time, but lifetime. So to the best of our knowledge, your dog, John, doesn't know where he is in the life cycle. We all know, and we know at all ages, just about, you know, past the early childhood years, we're able to do that. And goals are always set in temporal context. All of the goals we pursue, this discussion we're having, it's always in a temporal context. And because goals are always set in a temporal context, and that temporal context changes with age, it becomes increasingly constrained. Goals change systematically. Motivation changes systematically with age.
So motivation changes systematically with age. How? I mean, how does the motivation of a young person differ from the motivation of a middle-aged person differ from the motivation of an older person?
Well, young people tend to see their futures as open-ended, never-ending, expansive. And under that temporal frame, the motivational set, if you will, is to gather information, is to collect, is to prepare for some long and nebulous future. But when time horizons are constrained, people tend to focus on the present. And when you focus on the present, people tend to care most about what's emotionally meaningful, what's significant. People are able to see what's important and what's not, and they tend to savor life.
Well, there's a lot of philosophers who recommend living in the present, particularly in Eastern philosophies like Zen. You're taught, the secret of wisdom is to give up all your ambitions and just live in the present. Sounds like you get that philosophical gift for free as you get older.
I think it's one of the gifts you get.
I think I've read in some of your work, it's not just as we age that we can be faced with this motivational change, but any person in times of crisis for whom who believes that time is short. So even if they're not old, right? I mean, so this is like a very, this is a function of like really basic stuff.
You know, I think one of the most important messages from our work is that this is not about age. It changes systematically with age, but it's not aging for the reasons you're saying. If younger people are facing the end of their life because of an illness that they have, you see the same kind of changes. And you also see kind of transient changes when events occur like 9/11. So in 9/11 in New York City, right after the attacks, younger people and older people looked very much the same motivationally.
Right. That's why I was struck when Harry, a roving philosophical reporter, interviewed, said, "I age suddenly." Right. And I thought, well, exactly right, given... You know.
That's what I heard him say, too. I'm not sure if that's what he meant, but I that's exactly what I thought.
Yeah,
too.
Let me ask another thing from your work. I know that our memory changes, and I'm not just talking about the inability to remember or something like that, like decline in the faculty, but sort of the functioning of the faculty of memory changes as we age. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Memory declines with age, and anybody tells you that it doesn't is just very young. We do see these kinds of changes. But, you know, motivation also affects memory and generally cognition because we don't see everything in the world evenly, equal-handedly. Humans' brains don't operate like computers. We direct our attention to what's important, and that means what's relevant to our goals. And because older people are shifting their attention, or their goals are shifting, I should say, their attention also shifts. They don't see things that younger people see because they're not relevant.
I want to remind our listeners out there in Radio Land and in our live studio audience where you're listening to Philosophy Talk, we're talking about memory, we're talking about aging and the well-lived life.
We've been keep in mind while we're talking about
most recently about memory, and I want to remind our live studio audience, we invite your participation. We want your wisdom. You live this question every day. And we have a questioner now.
I'm David Redfield. Let's look on the bright side for a moment. We hear that there's some wisdom comes with age. Is that true, and can you identify it?
Psychologists have struggled to study wisdom. They define it as expertise in the matters of everyday living. Hmm. And it does appear to increase from young adulthood to middle age. According to the studies, it doesn't change much after that. So you see this kind of increase in middle-aged people, and then it kind of levels. The way it's been measured, I think it probably hasn't been measured quite right, and that if they really thought more about emotion and wisdom, then it would probably continue to increase.
But I think people in the older generations now are getting kind of a raw deal because how can you have wisdom about daily life when daily life is changing in front of you? I had a lot of wisdom about how to care for a 78 record, and then I had a lot of wisdom about how to care for, you know, a long play, and then I had a little wisdom about how to deal with an 8-track, but I have no idea how to listen to music anymore, and I think if I spent a lot of time figuring it out, it'd all be different next week.
I think people don't consider caring for records.
That's not part of
wisdom. That's falling in the wise category. It might be caring for a person, or
but still, Laura, I think there's a deeper question underneath John's thought there that I'd like to pressure.
Thank you. I rely on you to kind of under my question.
This evolutionary story you told about the value of grandparents, right? The time at which we evolved were when we lived in small circles, small communities. We didn't travel much. We weren't very distant from them. I mean, we live in a world where change is rapid and we're distant from the people that we're most deeply connected to. And I mean,
if my grandchildren, my oldest grandchildren's survival while their mother's busy depended on my wife's ability to deal with computers, we'd be in big trouble.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a real challenge, don't you think, for living well?
It is a real challenge, and I once heard somebody say, you know, there's no purpose for old people anymore because we have computers, we have the internet, we can always, you know, and get that information. But here's the thing. First of all, let me say, too, I think there's some truth to this. When we evolved on the savannah plains, the world wasn't changing so much. So, you know, there was a lot of stability, and by the time you got old, things were still the same, and you could teach a lot. It's true that the world is changing. But I think sometimes what people forget is that some of the most important lessons are about things that don't change. How do you care for another person and still express your own needs? How do you keep a family together? And how do you come to really fully, deeply appreciate that bad times pass and so do good times? And so those are the kinds of lessons that I think come with age, and they may be some of the most important ones. And I don't think we're going to get them on the internet.
Well, that's true. And, you know, some of the most important lessons I know, though, is kind of depressing because they're often kind of cynical, like politicians lie.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that as deep as I know anything, yeah. And younger people say, oh, yeah, but not this one. Yeah. Well, maybe Dennis Kucinich doesn't lie, but he's not much of a politician either.
we have more questions from our live studio audience. Tell us your name and tell us your question or comments.
Marian Lewinstein, and this is to Laura, who maybe has just answered it a little bit. Is it true that we become more tolerant and accepting of others and other circumstances as we age?
Yes. There is some kind of there's a conception about older people that floats around in the public that people become more rigid as they age. And that, if you look very closely at those data, it's people come to live their daily lives in a more routine way, like the same kind of foods that they, the same kind of music and that sort of thing. So there, if you call that rigidity, fine. But I call it knowing what you like, you know, and don't like. but people do become more accepting and tolerant of others as they get older. Or at least we know now that older generations are more accepting and more tolerant.
I think I read it reading some of your work. I think it's also true, isn't it, that older people manage their emotions better, manage conflict better, care deeply about the people closest to them, and they're in a way they've historically served as kind of the social glue in a way.
Right. Having somebody again, something you can't get from the internet, is somebody who knows you. And knows the people you care about and can help intervene when necessary and help you regulate those relationships. And again, you can't get that from a computer.
So it sounds like old people are worthwhile. I mean, there's a movie that came out a little while ago. It was called Children of Man.
Yeah.
And it was about the people just lost fertility for about 18 or 20 years, and there just was no younger generation, and it was tearing society apart. And I wondered, well, I mean, suppose there weren't any older people. Would it tear society apart? And it sounds like, well, maybe it wouldn't be perceived as quite as cataclysmic, but it'd be a pretty bad thing.
Mm-hmm. We'd lose an extraordinary amount of our humanity.
Okay, but now I want to ask again about we've sort of been talking about what the aged do for the rest of us, mm-hmm. right? I want to think about what a flourishing old age, right? Especially given we live longer and healthier. How should we think about the keys to flourishing as we age?
Many, many, many older people today, older Americans, are flourishing. You could just look around this room. And they're doing so all on their own. You know, the world we live in, the culture we have now, says almost nothing about old age, and we get very few supports to do it right or to do it wrong. And so people just kind of navigate it however they can. And in some sense, older people today are the pioneers of aging. You know, they're finding their own way. We could build a world that helps support older people. We could use culture to guide people, to give them some scripts, to give them some opportunities. We could solve the medical problems and so on and get new products out in the market that help people be mobile and communicate. And so we could do a lot to build a culture that supports aging, and we need to.
What prevents us from doing so?
That intractable belief, or the belief about, yes, exactly.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about aging and the well-lived life with Laura Carstensen from Stanford University. Here we have a question in the back there.
My name is Rod Crittenden. This is how I thrive. I work out in the gym every day, and I walk at least 2 miles.
Well, that's a good one. That's a good one.
What do you do when you walk? Do you think? Do you plan? Do you listen to your iPod?
I observe.
We've got another question right over there, Zoe.
It's really not a question. It's a statement. I think that it's wrong to imply that we have not made great changes for the elderly. We have in this country. Now, look how much longer everybody's living because of medical advances.
So, Laura, what do you say to that?
Yeah. Oh, well, we have. You know, it is true. But if we look at the way culture created old age, it was really about developing and making a world that was exquisitely attuned to the needs of the young. And when we built that world, it turns out it was good for all of us, older and younger alike. So the world is better and healthier for older adults. I agree. But we haven't even begun the systematic attack on the challenges in the second half of life in a very systematic way, solving the problems, getting what we need to the public.
Tell me what you mean. Help me think about what you mean. But what exactly we haven't begun, how far we are from your ideal and what your ideal would look like.
I mean, if you could change three things, you had a big hunk of the federal budget or the state budget, you had Arnold's ear, what would you do?
Well, I should mention that we've just started the Stanford Center on Longevity to do this. Okay. So we're getting on it. But what would we do? I'd bring the best minds together, scientific minds, with people from business and private sector, along with the creative communities. And I would address
problems.
A couple
problems. Philosophers maybe in there?
One or two, yeah. Absolutely. And then figure out what the mobility challenge is. What do we do now that we're living longer than our bones last? What are the issues? How do we fix it? And we get the stem cell biologists talking to the exercise physiologist and the nutritionists and so on, and we make new scientific discoveries, and then we get those findings available quickly to the public, and we turn it around.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing aging and the well-lived life with Stanford psychologist Laura Carstensen.
We've been discussing the profound psychological changes that we undergo as we age. Next, we talk about how to manage decline with dignity.
Plus, more questions from our live and wise audience here at the Classic Residence by Hyatt Senior Living Community when Philosophy Talk continues.
When I was 17,
Old Blue Eyes, Frank Sinatra, it was a very good year. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
We're discussing aging and the well-lived life with Laura Carstensen in front of the live studio audience at the Palo Alto Classic Residence by Hyatt.
We'll start out with a question from our live audience. Tell us your name and then tell us your comment or question.
My name is John Odenheimer, and I've heard it said that when somebody was asked, what does aging really feel like? They said it's like having, compared to being younger, a slight malaise. And I wondered what you'd think about that.
That's a common conception of aging. And one of the best-kept secrets about aging is that people get happier and more satisfied with their lives as they get older. The most troubling time in life, emotionally, is in the early 20s. Older people are less lonely than college students. They are better able to regulate strong negative emotions and better able to avoid negative situations than younger people are. So this is an area, the area of emotion and the regulation of strong emotions is an area where we see a steady improvement.
Let me ask you a follow-up question about that. Somebody might think, okay, I'm going to play the cynical philosopher just for a second. That's because that's a kind of defense mechanism.
Yeah.
It's not that older folks are really deeply satisfied with their life. Mm-hmm. It's that they see the decline and all that, and you defend yourself against horrible things. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that thought?
I think it's not true.
But tell me why it's not. I mean, tell me what shows
that. Well,
there's
a theory about aging called disengagement theory that was popular in the 60s and 70s. And this was a theory that said as people approached the end of their lives, they had to psychologically shut down in preparation for death, and that society also shut down from them and preparation for the loss of its citizen. And so you saw this mutual withdrawal and a deadening of emotions. I've been studying emotions in the laboratory and in everyday life for about the last 20 years. And my findings and findings in other laboratories around the world show that when you induce an emotion in an old person, we show them a film, we ask them to remember something, those emotions are just as strong as they are in younger people. But older people can make them stop more quickly. And they can also experience positive and negative emotions at the same moment. So older people are with age, people come to experience what we've been calling poignancy. You know, it's the tear in the eye when you smile at a picture of a loved one who has died, or you remember something from childhood and you're really happy, but there's a little bit of sadness, or you're very proud, but you're also a little bit embarrassed, and you're, you know, this kind of mixture of emotions. And it appears to be something that increases linearly with age. So it's more in the people in their 90s than people in their 80s than people in their
70s. There's another phenomenon like that I think I learned from reading work, let's see if I got this right. You compare memory in older people and younger people, and older people remember more pleasant things, and they remember things that were negative more pleasantly than they were, and younger people remember them more negatively. What's with that?
Yeah, we've come to call this the positivity effect, and it's been one of the most interesting discoveries from our research group over the years, is that for a long time, you know, studies of memory would just test people on their memory for nonsense words, as basically, or some you know, it completely irrelevant information. And it turns out that when you ask people to, you show them emotional information and ask them to remember it, that they remember the emotional a lot better than the non-emotional. And then if you show them both negative emotional information and positive emotional information, they remember the positive information and not so much the negative information. We think this is because of goals and motivation, that when your motivation is to experience life well in the moment, you remember what's positive and you notice what's positive. So your attention and your memory shifts consistent with your goals.
Yeah, we've got another question from our studio audience.
I found that the most challenging aspect of aging is culture shock. And by that, of course, I mean, you know, thinking, why can't these young folks do these things the right way? And I'd be curious to know if you have any ideas as to how to cope with that.
Fixing young people? Adapting to them, okay.
Well, there's two directions of fit, right? Either you can say, okay, that's pretty cool what the young people do, or you can say young people change, right?
Yeah.
Well, now, see, Laura, you may be too young to have experienced this in your own profession, but I'm sure older psychologists kind of look back and say, why aren't they running rats through mazes? I mean, you know, what's wrong with them? I mean, how are they going to know anything if they're not torturing pigeons? And I'm old enough in philosophy that I have that feeling. I say, gosh, this, all these younger people are interested in all this stuff that is just silly. Then the older person, I guess, in me kind of takes control and says, well, you know, that sounds a lot like what people thought when you were younger. You talked about disengagement, but I think there is a positive side of disengagement where you kind of slowly disengage from what a lot of people think. And as you get older, you feel that it's only a few people whose opinions you really ought to worry about, and maybe ultimately, as the philosophers say, just your own.
Yeah. Well, the theory we're working from is called selectivity theory. So, you know, people are becoming more selective in their choice of who matters and what matters and that sort of thing. I think that's true. You know, I must be surrounded by just exceptional older colleagues, some of whom are in this room, because I think it's been just the opposite in psychology, where more senior psychologists have been incredibly supportive and interested in sort of neuroscience and what that's doing to the field.
That's different from philosophy. But I want to shift topics just briefly, because there is this thing, we're mortal beings, and Our organs start to run out. Everything starts to run out. We decline. That's an inevitable fact of being mortal, no matter how long you extend it. And there's going to be a period of decline. How do we help people? What does society need to do better to help people manage their decline with in a way that respects human dignity? Because I'm a huge fan of human dignity, and I think you never lose it. But how do we do that?
Well, I agree with what you're suggesting. All of us are going to die, and almost all of us are going to be sick for some period of time before we die. And we have a very difficult time coming to terms with that. In fact, there are some philosophers who argue against a model of successful aging, I say with quotations, saying that successful aging really means not aging at all, and that that's the only model. But we are, almost all of us, going to become frail at some point and in decline physically, absolutely. I believe what we need to do is to accept that and then find ways to help people. Right now, what we tend to do is to fight death tooth and nail, you know, right to the very end, and consider a death a failure as opposed to think about how to let people die in a humane way.
We have a question from our live audience.
Beverly Broughton. I come from a family of long-lived people, and when our pets become unable to take care of themselves, we can euthanize them. Do you think there's going to be a time when we can do that with our declining elders?
Well, you know, there's a lot of fictions that grow up around issues like this, and philosophers tend to do their part. So one idea is, well, you know, what do you do with somebody who's, as we would say, brain dead? Well, we decide they're not a person so that it's okay. What do we do with somebody where we don't know if they're brain dead? What do we do with somebody who's got severe Alzheimer's and has gone past the, so to speak, happy phase into the place where there's a lot of pain, but they're really not an autonomous individual? As far as being able to make your own choice, if you're rational, I don't have any difficulty with that, but Laura might.
Yeah, well, I'm troubled that in the United States the conversation tends to be about either keeping people like on life support forever or euthanasia. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the kind of discussion that we have, and neither of those things are right, in my opinion. But what we haven't done is to think about ways and do research on ways scientifically to understand how we can help people die in a way that's humane, in a way where they're not in terrible pain, in a way where they might be feeling, in my opinion, some euphoria. I mean, we can do things. We can help people, and we're not. And I believe we're not because we're in denial. One of my favorite Woody Allen quotes is, to Americans, death is an option.
right.
And it's not, and we if we could begin to just say we all know that's true, and now let's get down to saying what it should look like.
Right. No, it's true. I think when Americans ask how to live a life, they don't think that part of that is how to end a life.
Right.
I mean, it's like you're writing a sentence that never has a period.
Right.
Right. But always, in a finite life, there's a period to it. There's an end to the sentence.
Exactly.
But we have another question from our live studio audience. Welcome, sir. Tell us your name and then give us your comment or question.
Gene Amdahl. One of the things that's troubled me most is a change in the morality or moral code of the country. I know I visited with my grandmother, who was 93. She was a homesteader. She saw some fire in the distance, harnessed up her horses, and went out and plowed a fire break and saved her home. She had children that were, the oldest was lived to 105, and one other lived to 100, and their youngest lived to 102. And they all maintained that same code of morals that I remember as a child. Can anyone shed light on why that morality change took place?
Well, she sounds like a remarkable woman. I mean, she clearly was. I'm inspired regularly by the students that I see on Stanford campus. There are some remarkable young people alive today who have remarkable values and morals. but they're going to be exceptional people like your mother, you know, once in a while in every generation, I believe.
Societies are complicated things. They're very complicated things. And one of the things that we need to do more of in our disintegrated society, and your work, I think, helps shows this, is integrate the young and the old more together in a community that talks back and forth, right? And maybe, you know, the work that you've done will help us bring that about. But on that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a really great conversation. Our guest has been Laura Carstensen. She's professor of psychology at the Stanford University, director of the Lifespan Development Laboratory, and a very prolific author on the subject of psychological change through aging. Laura, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And our deep thanks to everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Let's give you, and you give you, a round of applause.
Thank you, folks. That's for you. So, John, I know you are already, you're already wise because you're older than I, and you probably have nothing to learn from me, but you probably had something to learn from them. What did you learn today?
Oh,
and
I learned
certainly something to learn
I
from
learned
Laura.
A lot today. I always have my... it's always fun when we interview psychologists, you know, because they do such interesting things. I mean, so much philosophy is supposed to be a priori, like 2 + 2 = 4, the soul is immortal, God is perfect, so forth and so on. But, you know, a lot of it isn't. A lot of it really depends on the facts.
Oh,
the facts about the soul, the facts about the mind, the facts about the brain, the facts about life, the facts about what actually makes people happy, as opposed to what Aristotle thought made people happy. So even us philosophers, the kings and queens of the whole intellectual world, really need psychologists.
Oh, definitely,
and I was reminded of that.
Oh, that's definitely true. And I mean, because the facts are important because you've got to integrate the facts into a theory. I think psychology needs philosophy too, because you take the deliverances of psychology and as of all science, you try to integrate them. You try to tell a normative story about how what this implies about how we ought to live and all that stuff. And you're right, we learned a lot. And we learned a lot from our audience because there was a lot of wisdom there. And we're really grateful. But, you know, it's time to bring this conversation to a close. But it goes on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well, if you're able to download podcasts from anything, which I can't, but some your grandchildren can explain how to do it. And now, with a final word on aging, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, last year the neuroscientist Robert Sapolsky wrote an essay for The New Yorker called When Do We Lose Our Taste for the New? The essay opened with him in his neurobiology lab and his young assistant who would play, quote, sonic youth for hours, and the next day late Beethoven. Irish folk music would give way to Gregorian chants and then to Shostakovich, John Coltrane, big band hits, Emma Schumach, Puccini arias, Philip Glass, and klezmer, unquote. Sapolsky, who was in his 40s, found this annoying. He confessed that his own taste in music was pretty much confined to Bob Marley's greatest hits. Well, I could relate. I was annoyed enough when vinyl albums were replaced by cassettes. Imagine my horror when cassettes were replaced by CDs. Videotapes. I loved videotapes of old movies. I hated the idea of DVDs and having to buy a whole new machine to play a flimsy disc I didn't want in the first place. But then I found out that all the old movies I loved as a kid, the ones out of copyright, could be found at Walgreens or a dollar store for a buck. Roy Rogers movies, my friends. He sings. He has a beautiful, smart horse. He beats up bad guys. What more do you want from a movie? These kids today. Anyway, Sapolsky's irritation with youth gave way to scientific curiosity, sort of. He wrote, quote, my research assistants and I called radio stations that specialize in the music of various periods. In each case, we posed the same two questions to the station manager. When was most of the music that you play first introduced? And what is the average age of your listeners? Unquote. Whether this is an appropriate use of research assistants, I leave you to judge, but Sapolsky discovered that if you are more than 35 years old when a style of poppy music is introduced, there's a greater than 95% chance that you will never choose to listen to it. Then he did the same thing with food, sushi to be exact. He found that among people who are older than 39, the odds were greater than 95% that they would never touch it. He also found that if you're older than 23, the odds are 95% that you do not have and will never opt for a tongue stud. So when it comes to tongue studs, old age sets in early. But why do we become resistant to novelty as we get older? Well, Sapolsky wonders instead, maybe we need to try to understand why repetition becomes appealing. Sapolsky suggests that it's evolutionary. He cites physiologist Jared Diamond, who argued that one reason Cro-Magnons outlasted Neanderthals was they lived longer. If a catastrophe occurred, chances are good there was a Cro-Magnon old enough to remember what to do based on the last time a catastrophe happened. Good news for me, I think. Now, sure, I avoided the latest by Christine Aguilera, and my mouth is stud-free, but I've been boning up on old singing cowboy movies. If there's ever a disaster aversion strategy that requires yodeling, that makes me the go-to guy. You can even pay me in sushi if you have some lying around that you don't want. Call me young at heart, but I love this stuff. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2007.
This episode of Philosophy Talk has been made possible in part by a generous grant from the Stanford Humanities Center.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to John Bender, Susan Sebbard, Susan Spiller, Marilyn Lewinstein, David Redfield, and the staff and residents of the Classic Residence by Hyatt, Palo Alto.
The production team included Dan Brandon, Brian McKay, Devin Strelovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, and Zoe Corneli.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University. Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.